the Natural Alternative Podcast, Madonna Guy and Truth Seeker Greggy. So we've just learned those stats last week, and new stats are coming out around the globe with the actual number of people. They looked at one study in the UK with people 24 years and under, and they found there were 8 people who had no comorbidities. Now, this doesn't mean that the people with comorbidities aren't getting unwell and that people, you know, who do get coronavirus aren't getting unwell. This is not what we're saying at all. But the manipulation is there in the statistics. The manipulation is there in the data. The manipulation's been there with the mainstream media and the politicians. And just watching how it's all rolled out has been a very interesting global dynamic.
Yeah, well, look, I'm sure this will be going internationally to all of your followers, Madonna, but here in Australia, where we're speaking, there have been a handful of politicians speaking out loudly, again, being repressed by mainstream media, being ridiculed by the majority of parliament, but they're not giving up. They're still fighting hard to share these true statistics. And I saw a fantastic interview this morning. It was a parliamentary speech by a Queensland Member of Parliament, Shane Knuth, and he's from far north Queensland. And he uncovered all of the statistics that you're talking about right now. And incredible for me, it's part of the mass psychosis, it's the brainwashing of the majority of the people, it feels like. And we talk about cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
And the people who can't see what we see think we have cognitive dissonance.
Yes. And yeah, they're flipping it back on us. Yes.
And we know they have cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
And I actually speak about this a bit and I say, well, we've all got cognitive dissonance. I would just rather have my version of it than your version.
Nice one. Yes.
But Shane Knuth actually uncovers a lot of the statistics. And this is where this is common sense. I look at why is it not clear to people here in Queensland? We had what started on the 17th of December, a vaccine mandate where the unvaccinated were basically not allowed to have a life. We could not do anything publicly other than essential services. We can't go to a pub or club and have a drink with friends. We can't eat at a restaurant. We can't go to a music concert or a sporting event. Somehow, this will stop the spread of COVID.
Yes.
But what coincided with that vaccine mandate was the new variant of this coronavirus completely blowing up in Queensland. I mean,
remember, they opened the borders at the same time for double jabbed people.
Yes, to the vaccinated, not the unvaccinated.
To the fully vaccinated, yes. Yes.
And so we can't possibly be spreading this because we're basically locked down in life. And all of a sudden we've gone from, 2,000 cases. I mean, it's hard to believe that all of this is over 2,000 positive cases in Queensland up until 17th of December.
Yes.
And when I say cases, remember most of them were asymptomatic, which means they were never sick at all.
Yes.
And 7 deaths for anyone watching somewhere else in the world, up until the 17th of December in Queensland, we had 7 deaths in 21 months actually. And that's why we've all been in lockdown, wearing masks under mandate and socially distancing, because we'd stop the spread of this. Now, every death is tragic. Don't get me wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
People love to get angry at us talking about this. But every year in Queensland, somewhere between 300 and 500 people die of the flu, the seasonal flu. We've never had a lockdown or a mandate ever over the flu. So anyway, Shane exposes everything that's happened since the 17th of December. And we can't blame the unvaccinated. It's ironic, all of a sudden I'm an anti-vaxxer. I have been vaccinated for everything and so have my kids. And I'm very much opposed to this vaccine because, in truth, it's not a vaccine. It's not registered. It is globally under phase 3 clinical trial And currently about 4 billion human beings are the lab rats. They are the guinea pigs. The medical profession is collecting data on all of these people who put their hand up for a clinical trial of an experimental drug. And to be fair, we need to call it an experimental gene therapy. It's never been used on humans before. Like, and we've rolled it out on 4 billion. I don't keep track of the numbers, to be honest. I don't believe
the numbers just make me sad. If anything, when I see the numbers, especially when they're talking 12 years and older, that just breaks my heart every time I see it. And it's tragic, so far, once again, because I'm a naturopath, I see clients. And most people, once again, the cognitive dissonance, if they've been fully jabbed, they don't want to know anything, which is fine. You know, I wish them all the best in the world and I pray for their health and longevity for as long as, you know, they're meant to be here on the planet.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting. Once they start opening up that tiny little crack of information allowing, then they start talking about, oh, yes, I did have a friend who had a stroke, or, oh, I have had a cousin who's been in hospital with it. And personally, for me, I've had about 15 family members who have either been, now I've got a big family, don't get me wrong, but people who have with illnesses, all the comorbidities, they have not been well after the jab and some have died. So it's been very interesting watching it and devastating, you know, because so many of my clients know people who have been hospitalized. They've been told they're wrong, that it's nothing to do with the jibbity jab, especially here in Australia. I think it's a bit different in other places in the world, but here in Australia, our doctors and nurses seem totally under the thumb. There's a local doctor here actually who had given he'd only given 300 jabs, and he's done a lot of research, so they were his clients who wanted them, and he was actually giving a lot of information about it, and he is on suspension at the moment because he'd only given 300 and had given some mask exemptions. He had not been allowed to give a single jab exemption. But because of those twofold things, giving mask exemption and only having done 300 jabs, he's now considered a liability to the AMA and the TGA in Australia.
It's, you know, I think it's very sad. We entrust the health industry with our health. But as you know, you're a bit of a fringe dweller on the outside, and it has become the illness industry, not the health industry.
Yes.
And so I'm not an anti-vaxxer as such. I'm opposed to experiments being forced onto human beings against their will.
Yeah.
The Nuremberg Code was put in motion back in 1947 after World War II because of atrocities done to humans during the war. And a lot of people are talking about Nuremberg II happening right now.
Reiner-Fulmich, yep.
Yeah, amazing. People will be brought to justice. And you know, I think a lot of that is still happening. It's not being reported on and it's hard to find information.
Yes.
But I guess, you know, beyond this happening for the last 2 years, it is 2 years already, which is crazy. I mean, this started 2 years ago. But I've been looking into a lot of the health industry, you know, going back over through my own journey, post-depression and really big business and the way it's structured and what has happened to my dairy industry and to the dairy farmers. It's all part of the same machine. You know, it's big industry, big business, and it's controlling the way we operate and function. And for me, I bring back to health post-depression. I did take medication. I took antidepressants. I felt I needed to at the time. But I got to a point where I started to, I don't want to be a slave to Big Pharma.
Yeah.
I don't want to have that as my solution. And I weaned myself off antidepressants 7 years ago now.
How long did it take you? Because so many people go through this and it takes quite some time for many people.
Look, I got down to my last script of tablets. I had the prescription and I cut back to a half a tablet a day until they were gone.
Yes.
And that was it. So instead of 1 month supply, that became 2 months supply.
And then you just stopped.
And then I did not get another prescription. That was July 2015.
Yes.
So, but then after that, again, because of my lifestyle, and I'm going to say I'm not an alcoholic, but I have lent on alcohol.
Yes.
As therapy.
I could probably say the same thing, Greggy.
I think a lot of us have over the years. It's probably, you know, better than being on meth. We don't want to go there.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't been on any illegal substances.
Yeah.
But alcohol is so readily available and it works, except it doesn't.
You know, exactly.
It numbs you. It numbs you.
Yeah.
But the side effect is you're in a perpetual state of hangover, fuzzy brain, mood swings, fatigue, all these things, these negative things that alcohol will do to you if you drink too much. And so at the time when I had severe hypertension, my first round with hypertension was 2015, and I was 180 over 120 as a 46-year-old.
Okay.
Now, that's pretty high. You know, I really think, okay, that made me pay attention. I've had a few wake-up calls in my life with health. It keeps kicking me in the ass, and I need to listen. And that was so that was 7 years ago. But I said at the time, I don't want to take a prescription medication. I can fix this. Because I was drinking more than a carton of beer a week.
Right.
I was drinking 8 or 10 cups of coffee a day. I was eating junk food on the road. My life was a bit crazy. And it was just convenience, convenience, convenience. And so I did. I cut back on the alcohol. You know, I went to a naturopath because my doctor said, what you need is this prescription. You need to lower your blood pressure. That's life-threatening. And I just said, I'll get another opinion, went to a naturopath, got on magnesium, cut back from, you know, 30 beers a week to 9. You know, she wasn't too hard on me. She said, what is doable? What can you maintain? And we decided 3 beers, 3 days a week, 4 beers, 4 days, no beer, and cut back immediately to 2 cups of coffee a day, not one, but 2, you know, took the magnesium, ate real food. I mean, that was a big thing. Stop eating junk food. And it took about 2 or 3 months, but I brought my blood pressure down at that time to about 115 over 77, I think it was.
Oh, well done. Yeah.
Without medication.
Awesome.
But then life gets in the way and I get lazy again down the track a few years later. I monitored it for, you know, a while and I stayed healthy for a while. But end of marriage and more depression and like all these things that happen, it's just difficult to deal with. And we get lazy again in life. And you know, I've sort of been in and out of the laziness trap, I'll call it. Until recently, my eyes started slipping and I'm 52 now, but last year my sight, my vision was slipping and I was worried. And I went to my optometrist. He said, just natural aging, you're okay. And 2 months later, I'm like, no, I'm not okay. There's something wrong. There's something happening here. And I started getting black spots. It's distorting my clarity when I'm looking at people at close range. So I went to mum and dad's optometrist, got a second opinion. And he straight away said, I think there's something wrong with your macula, but you need to see an eye specialist. And he got me in urgently 4 days later. I mean, you know how all the specialists are booked out these days. But 4 days later, I got an appointment. And the eye specialist said, there's a big problem here. He said, so your eyeball pressure is very high. There had been burst blood vessels and bleeding in the back of my eyeballs. And he said, you either have very high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes or both. And at the time, you know, I had no other blood pressure symptoms like headaches or, you know, nausea or just different things, but the eyes were the symptom.
Yes.
He said, I don't want to be alarmist, but you are sitting on a ticking time bomb, and you need to see your GP today. So make an appointment, see a GP, get checked out. They put drops in your eyes to dilate the pupils at the specialist. So I couldn't drive for 2 hours. I stayed with my little sis down the coast for a couple of hours until I could drive home, came home to an appointment. My sister has, youngest daughter has type 1 diabetes. So she has the blood sugar kits, and she's got a blood pressure machine. I was 4.2, which is great. And I've had numerous blood tests since December. All this testing was done in December 2021. And but my blood pressure was 209/145.
Whoa, you are lucky to be here. Which is scary high.
Like,
you're meant to be here, Greggy.
That, you know, for anyone who doesn't take their blood pressure and or understand blood pressure, that's scary high.
That, yes.
So I went back to the GP. He measured me in clinic, 220/140, and he said, I am going to prescribe you a medication. And I told him, I've been here before, you know, but not that bad. 180/120 last time. I said, I don't want to rely on medication. I want to fix this naturally. He said, I'm giving you two choices today. This was on the 7th of December. He said, I'm going to check you into hospital now, or you're going to take the medication I prescribed to you. I said, okay, I'll take the medication. I'd got lazy again, Madonna. I was back to drinking more than a carton of beer a week. I was really struggling with a lot of this COVID stuff and the end of my life coming as we knew it on the 17th of December. We had been trying to sell our family farm now 4 months, and it was just dragging out, and we were under a lot of financial pressure with the family, a lot of work pressure, and now the COVID situation. And it just all culminated in me getting lazy and, you know, the ripple effect turning into, I guess, a tsunami of bad effects on my body. And so I did, you know, I can make the changes I need to make. I can be disciplined if I know it's life and death.
Yeah.
Because that was a very big wake-up call. He said I was at risk of having a stroke any minute. He said you could have a stroke in your sleep tonight.
Well, you know the number that I sort of was told at a seminar once? Is it, you know, so the 209/145, so Steve and Diane, so the diastolic, the bottom number, for every 3 points over 80, you increase your risk of stroke by another 30%.
Wow.
So when I heard that number, 145, I was
65.
Like, that's pretty freaking high.
20, that's, you know, nearly 22 times.
Yeah, so that's sort of interesting.
22 times 30%, that's a lot of percent.
Yes.
So I did, you know, I went home, I stopped drinking beer completely, didn't have a beer that week. I had no coffee, no tea, no caffeine for the week. I did not eat junk food. I cooked from scratch. And, you know, a lot of this stuff's been challenging for me because I've been living alone, you know, the life of a bachelor.
Yeah.
Hopefully not for much longer. Happy to talk about that soon. But, you know, I've been and sometimes that your motivation can completely become repressed, which has this spiral effect in a downward direction, because then you make bad choices that further impact your motivation and you know, energy levels. I was very fatigued, and mentally I was foggy. So, but within 4 days, no, sorry, 3 days, I went back. That was Tuesday, Friday. I was 180/120. He said that, you know, that's still too high. I understand that's still too high. And I had checked myself at 160/110 at home. I'm always higher in the clinic, you know, bit of anxiety. I don't know. You don't want a bad reading. So he spoke to his superior because I needed to see a doctor immediately. I kind of got the new kid on the block, and no disrespect to any trainee doctors, but that's why they call it practicing medicine. You're practicing medicine from the day you graduate, and he didn't know my history, and he said, I'm going to prescribe you a second medication because that's still too high. And I said, that's fine. I'm not going to take it. I'm happy to review in a month's time. I'm bringing it down. I believe I can bring it down. And he gave me the script, I went away, didn't get the tablets, came home, kept being a good boy, doing all the right things. And Tuesday the following week, so a week later, I was 128 over 89.
Well done.
So, you know, that was a massive turnaround. I felt quite dizzy and very fatigued. And without having a medical knowledge of the human body, I guess if the body goes from 220 over 140 down to 129, 128 over 89, that's a big change for the body in 1 week.
Yes. Your blood sugar didn't know what to do with you. Your blood pressure, yeah.
Yeah. So he said to me, first thing he said, oh, that must have been the second prescription I gave you. And I said, no, I told you I wasn't going to take them. And I didn't. And he was like, mystified. Wow. And the eye specialist I saw the same day, 1 week later, and he was amazed. He said, your eyeball pressure is back to normal. Keep doing what you're doing. I can't promise your eyes will repair, but you've stemmed the damage, and hopefully. And both he and the doctor, the eye specialist and the doctor, both said to me, don't need to see you for 2 months. Keep doing what you're doing. We'll have a checkup in 2 months. So it was really interesting. I stayed on top of things and kept the blood pressure respectable. It was still jumping around a little bit, but I was not feeling well. I was still struggling. I was struggling with dizziness and fatigue and what felt like depression to me. We had some issues happening on the farm. We were nearing the sale of our family farm. My family's been here for 85 years, so I know there's a little bit of emotion getting carried with that. And then we had a bunch of employees just quit working. and there was a lot of pressure. My uncle is 81. My dad is 78. And there's me. And all of a sudden, we went from a workforce of 6 to 3. And I had what I can best describe as a nervous breakdown. I collapsed. I crashed. I went down in a screaming heap. I blew up at Dad and Uncle Ray. I cried and I couldn't get it together. I couldn't function. And I guess, you know, all of that happened in mid-January, so 5-6 weeks after the initial diagnosis. And I haven't done a lot of work because we're having a chat now, 24th of Feb. So really for the last month, I haven't done much work. I'm still struggling a little bit in my health, and mentally I was battling depression again. But what happened was really interesting. 2 weeks ago when I had that 2 month checkup, like I had my blood work and urine samples done 3-4 times back in early December, and everything came back clear. They did an ECG, my heart was good. I brought my blood pressure down. Everything was good. They put me on this medication. I go back to my original doctor who knows all my history. He knows I've had hypertension before. And he looks at everything. He said, it's great. You know, you're doing the right things. And he looks at the blood work and he said, but your liver function is off the chart. And I said, well, all the changes I've made are for the better. Like I'm drinking 2 stubbies of beer a week again, maybe 4 stubbies of beer a week. I am having a cup of coffee. I'm cooking real food from scratch, not eating junk food 5 days a week, not even 1 day a week. You know, maybe twice in 2 months I'd had junk food. I said, the only thing I've really changed is the stuff you guys put me on for my blood pressure. And he looked up what I'd been prescribed and he said, oh, okay, well, that medication has a known effect on the liver as a side effect. Great. I have zero trust in Big Pharma, honestly, Madonna, and this has been something within me for a long time. He said, so what you need to do, stop taking that immediately. Don't take another tablet. He said, I'll prescribe you a new one which doesn't have the known liver side effect. It operates in a similar way. And I'm like, okay, I accept that. And I did. I come home. I stopped that last tablet. I'm taking the new tablet. Within 2 days, I already feel, wow, I'm feeling more like my old self again. Like the turnaround was really fast. But I was still getting dizzy in the morning a little bit. And I lie down 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, I'd have this tablet when I wake up. 10 o'clock, I'm dizzy. So I actually stopped taking that tablet for a little while to see what happened. My blood pressure got down to 110 over 77 2 days after I stopped taking the tablet. But then it sort of snuck back up to 150 over 100. And I've decided to take that tablet again because I've got a checkup next week. Okay, I'm just going to take it again. But I really, the thing that I want to see is a positive turnaround in the liver, because I'm a little bit on limited time here to get everything right, because I'm leaving the country in a couple of weeks' time. And I'll explain that in a moment. But so what actually happened? He told me my liver reading was effectively like somebody who had been drinking 8 beers a day for 20 years. So this prescription medication in 8 weeks had turned me from perfectly healthy liver. I had other issues with the blood pressure.
Yeah.
You know, these prescription medications that are supposedly safe, they're registered for human use, they solve one problem, but they just shift it to another part of the body. And yeah. So I'm a really big believer in real food is our medicine. And like, I've got to stay disciplined in this. You can't get away with stuff as you get a bit older. I'm not 22 anymore. I'm 52.
Yes.
The body doesn't have the ability to heal itself as quickly when we make poor lifestyle choices. So you know, I've lost 10 kilograms in the last 2 months because I'm being healthy again, and I've cut back on the beer and eating real food. And it's amazing. You know, it's like we just get lazy, and sometimes it's hard to stop being lazy because it's a cycle.
Absolutely. Yeah. And maybe that's why a lot of people just want health experts to tell them what to do all day, every day, because it's easier.
So it's because I share my journey, I often share with people what happens to me and then what I do.
Yes.
I don't want it to be a woe is me and life's not fair, although sometimes it might sound that way, but I share what I do to solve the problem. And I troubleshoot in my own life and solve problems, you know, whether that's stress related or depression, you know, end of marriage, you got to rebuild yourself. And hey, it happens to half of us these days. We all go through it in a different way, and you got to do a lot of inner work. And sometimes the inner work is spiritual, and sometimes it's just health and nutrition, and sometimes it's exercise or whatever it takes. But in the past when I had hypertension, and again this time, people are asking me, wow, that's amazing. Like, what did you do? And I tell them, this is what I did. Oh, no, that's too hard. Just give me my tablet.
Exactly. Like,
they want to live a poor lifestyle
and
take a tablet to mask the problem that they're too lazy to fix with real solutions, real food.
Exactly.
Know? Real
nutrition. Which I think before we started chatting, we were talking about both of us are passionate about keeping the environment clean and healing the world and how we can go about doing that. And from a naturopathic perspective, I believe that pesticides are a huge impact on people's health, especially things like glyphosate, which did you see the interview with Professor Stephanie Seneff and Joseph McCullough?
No.
So Stephanie Seneff and Peter McCullough, they've co-authored a paper that they've spent 6 months writing in the mechanisms of neurological damage of the jibbity jab.
Yeah.
But she, back in the 80s, she started looking at all these health issues that were coming through, and she was the first person to shine a light. I think it was the early 2000s, maybe 2003. She's been an MIT researcher for over 30 years. She looks like she's been plucked straight out of the hills in Byron Bay. She's just this down-to-earth, everyone's grandmother sort of look. She's amazing. But she was the one who found that glyphosate can have detrimental effects on our genes and can actually delete healthy genes that help us to reduce inflammation and genes that help us to reduce our risk of cancer. So she was a dynamo. So now she's looking at the mechanisms of the spike protein and what neurological damage it can cause.
You'll have to pop that in the links in the description of this podcast, because I'm keen to check it out later. And the other one, I'm guessing you've come across a bloke by the name of Dr. Zach Bush.
Oh yeah, love him.
And you know, he's brilliant. And I think, you know, one of the great interviews I've seen with him was, well, he's done a couple of really good ones, but he did one with Rich Roll, a podcaster, and very interesting because Rich Roll is a vegan And I'm very anti-vegan, and I'm happy to have a chat with anyone who can't understand why I would be that way. But, you know, we don't have to go there today, or we can. But the other one he did an interview with Del Bigtree about COVID right at the start of all this.
Yeah.
And that was one of the interviews I just thought was an incredible interview, went for an hour and a half, and it was one of the things that woke me up to, why are things being taken down from YouTube? Why are things being blocked and banned when they are real science? These are real scientists. And, yes. You know, Del Bigtree was taken down from YouTube interviewing people like Dr. Zach Bush. And that didn't make sense to me, because this is a guy who has built a career in science with real research.
Yes.
They're the people we need to be listening to. And now we can't see them. They've been taken down. They've been discredited. They're blocked and banned. And, you know, that probably gave rise to a lot of information being shared on platforms like Rumble and BitChute and Odyssey.
Yes.
And there was no censorship on those platforms. And like, that's why Joe Rogan went from YouTube to Spotify. He's been given free rein to talk about whatever he wants to whoever he
free
wants.
Free rein-ish.
Well, probably. But at least he's talking to a lot of good people
he
was not able to.
Yeah, Dr. Zach Bush was the first person I ever heard who differentiated the microbiome and the biome. So way back early in the beginning, he was talking about viruses and how many of them are in the water supply and in the air. And when we hug people, we reduce our risk of respiratory infections by 30% because it's all about sharing our microbiome. So all this isolation with people is the worst thing we can do. During a pandemic, we're reducing our immunity.
He said our best potential outcome to, you know, reduce the spread of COVID, to not get COVID, was to hug 15 people a day. That was his recommendation. And then what do we have? Social distancing. You can't even shake hands anymore. It's like unbelievable. It was anti-science. You know, the social movement, social distancing movement was anti-science,
yes,
but it was just adopted worldwide. It was unbelievable. Yes.
The other cool thing, because I've listened to a bit of Zach Bush, I just love him, and I was wondering, because my hubby has just joined a company called Topcon, which you might have heard of. They're involved in satellites communicating with, they do many things, but the part that my hubby's involved in, they satellites communicate with tractors so that they're keeping an eye on how much pesticide is being dropped. And when I first heard his job was about pesticides, I'm like, oh, damn, you're helping, you know, the other side. But because Zach Bush actually said, and I made Jason listen to this part, that in America, 0.0008% of the pesticides end up on the food. The rest ends up in the soil, in the water supply, and we get a massive amount of pesticides breathing in our air supply. So these pesticides are in the entire community because we are, and then they're affecting our health in that way as well. So even when we're trying to look after our health, we need to be working on our health and detoxifying on a daily basis. Obviously, that's my belief as a naturopath. But Zach, and you know, that percentage was ridiculous.
The other really interesting thing he probably explained in a way not many had was the impacts of glyphosate. He's specialized in glyphosate. He originally came from a background of chemotherapy, and he then compared or likened the effect of glyphosate on the soil to chemotherapy on the body. And glyphosate kills, you know, kills things, but it's water soluble. And this is the really frightening thing. Because it's water soluble, it gets taken into the body and into the brain.
Right. So, the other thing that he said was that the glyphosate was used during World War II as an antibiotic, and then it was used as a parasitic, an antiparasitic. So they thought, gee, what happens if we put it onto plants? And, you know, and it's the number one thing they sell in Bunnings now.
Yeah.
It's the number one poison for people to buy. They've stopped the organic fertilizers and things like that. They're only selling it now.
So there has been a bit of an awakening to all of that, but it's kind of still a fringe movement, isn't it? It's sort of not mainstream yet.
Yes.
And I guess that's where it's interesting, Madonna, like I was introduced to a group going back to 2015, I believe I first met the founders of Australian Farmers for Climate Action. And I became involved with that group. I was one of the founding nine farming members Australia-wide. And that came about because at the time we were looking at putting in solar panels on our farm to generate clean energy for our daily use. And I was very interested in the renewable energy field. And I kind of looked at what's happening around the planet and that we need to take better care of our planet. That was my motivation. That whole movement with some people, it's drifted in a strange direction. Again, anti-science. It hasn't become about what can we do that's best for the greater good. It's what can we do to drive an agenda that might not really be based on science. And,
yes,
you know, that whole climate change and global warming, and it's about end of days of planet Earth and you know, going to completely change the way we eat because cows are killing the planet. This is what's being taught to our kids in schools.
Yes.
And this is part of why I'm so opposed to the vegan movement, because they're all about a plant-only diet. But this doesn't work in the balance of our ecosystems. We need animals to recycle carbon. Now, we're learning about carbon sequestration, and that's actually the quickest way to solve some of our climate problems with the help of animals.
Right.
And again, you know, there's a bloke in Zimbabwe, Dr. Alan Savory, has done an enormous amount of work in this space, and it's holistic management. And it's the way we can utilize livestock, especially cattle. But when you think about it, Australia as a continent, as a country, is a great example of how the vegan movement cannot sustain our population, because 80% of Australia is kind of, it's not arable land that we can grow crops.
Yes.
It can carry cattle and sheep and goats, you know, but it can't grow crops. So the animals can eat the crops that are not suitable for human consumption in those parts of our country.
Yeah.
And animal products are nutritionally dense. So here's something that's lost on a lot of vegans. 86% of people who try that lifestyle revert to being normal human beings because their body and their brain starts failing them.
Yes.
Because they cannot absorb the required nutrients from plants only.
Yes.
And I kind of watched it with interest over the years. There are some very vocal vegans, and they claim to have been so for 20, 30 years. And I think the majority of them who claim that are lying because they're cheating. They're sneaking food that can help maintain their body. But I think maybe there's a very small percentage of genetic outliers as humans.
Yes.
Who can literally just eat plants and sustain health
and thrive on
that
it.
Diet.
Yeah. There was a study in
very small percentage.
Yeah, there was a study in South Africa a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago. I was at a ketogenic conference. So they were talking ketogenic foods, paleo, that sort of thing. And one of the researchers, he took people who were about the same age, say 25 to 40 years old, marathon runners, about the same weight, same height, same build, so that he was comparing. He didn't care whether they were what race they were. He just wanted people approximately the same height and weight. And half of them had been vegan for a minimum of 2 years, and half of them had been keto diet for a minimum of 2 years. And obviously these were elite athletes. And he found over his 2 weeks, they were pin cushions like five times a day. He did lots of experiments on them. And he did find that they were pretty bloody close when it came to their health. But the ketogenic people were fraction better. But, you know, they'd all, you know, they'd leave us in the dust, Greggy, you know.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting that he, with people who had been doing it and with the lifestyle that they needed to be marathon runners, he actually didn't see a lot of change. As a naturopath, though, because I do a lot of testing in my clinic, I do live blood screening and bioimpedance screenings and bioresonance scanning and things like that. So what I tend to find is it doesn't take long for people's B12 and iron to drop through the floor. It can activate their MTHFR genes. So there's this gene that, and sort of with a history of depression, it that MTHFR gene, if it's active and not working well, it can mess with that conversion of melatonin to serotonin to melatonin again. It can mess with our ability to activate our B vitamins in our foods into activated forms that help our brain work and our liver function and all sorts of things. So it's very interesting. And I had one lady once, she came in and she showed me her blood work, and her iron levels were like 30, 30, 30, 30. And then all of a sudden they were like 8. And I said, oh my gosh, what happened like a month ago? As a woman, did you have a heavy bleed? Did you have this? Did you have that? She said, no, I became vegan. She'd been vegan for less than a month, and her iron was less than a third of what it had been. And that was within the first month. And I think the whole thing is, I think they've been trained to believe it's good for people and good for the planet and good for their bodies, and they don't know any difference. So I think this has been 30 years of brainwashing.
It's grooming. It's grooming of our students and through the university system. And if our kids are being taught that cows cause climate change, then they think they need to make these changes to become a part of the solution, not the problem.
Yeah.
And so many of the vegan documentaries that have been made in recent years, I actually call them mockumentaries. They are mocking the truth. They are anti-science. They're cherry-picking data that supports their story, but it's not real science.
Yes.
And we saw exactly the same thing happen. Go back into the 50s and 60s, and, you know, there was a doctor called Ansel Keys, and he did a lot of research at the time into heart disease and cholesterol. And he found that there was a direct correlation between the consumption of animal products and animal fats to high cholesterol and heart disease. And what he did was famously known as the 5-country study. But it was actually a 22-country study. And he wiped out 17 of the countries that actually concluded his research was incorrect.
Right.
So he threw out all the countries that conflicted with what he was trying to find. That's not how science should work.
Yeah.
A scientist is trying to prove themselves wrong, not right. They need to disprove, like they got to prove that they're wrong until they can't prove that they're wrong.
Yes.
Now, he was cherry picking data that said, yes, I'm right. See, I know I'm right because the data says so. And at the same time, there was another doctor from England, John Yudkin, and he found that sugar was causing all of these problems with heart disease and cholesterol and issues that he was completely discredited and defamed, just like we've seen happen in the last 2 years to a lot of very high-profile doctors. And in 1977 and then 1980 in the American Senate or Congress, they passed the McGovern Report, which built our modern food pyramid. And it flipped upside down everything we're eating, you know, put the grains at the base and vegetables and fruit, and at the top, you know, almost eliminate eating animal products.
Yeah.
It started in 1980, 42 years ago.
Yes.
Now, you've been involved with the keto movement, and I'm guessing Gary Fetke, Gary and Belinda Fetke, you would have been involved with some of their teachings, but the low carb down under, I think they call that movement. But, you know, it's taken 40 years for us to unravel all the lies. And a lot of people to this day, so, you know, I've been hosting farm tours on our dairy for Real Milk, a company I formed in 2013. Mm. We never did a low-fat dairy product, all full cream.
Awesome.
And people in their 60s, 70s, 80s who are coming for tours still asking, can you please do a low-fat version? My doctor's telling me we need to be eating low-fat dairy products. We've known for 40 years that that's misinformation, but it still lingers to this day.
And just so that people understand this, what ends up happening is that when you eat fats and protein, you release a hormone called glucagon. Glucagon is a fat-burning hormone. and it helps to balance your blood sugar. When you eat carbohydrates, it turns into sugar that increases insulin. So it's pro-gaining fat and it's pro-diabetes long term. So, and you'll probably get me on the in milk, I sort of think of it as 7, 8, and 9, whether maybe it's 7 grams of fat to 8 grams of protein and 9 of carbs or something like that. In the average milk, would it be something like that, Greggy?
I couldn't tell you the analysis, but anyway.
Let's pretend that's it. It's something like that. So what you need to do is add together your protein and your fat. So say your 7 and your 8 together, which is 15, compared to 9 of carbohydrates, which makes it a pro-fat burning milk when it's full fat. You take the 7 grams of fat out of there and you've got 8 grams of protein and 9 grams of carbs. Might be more than that, but, you know, basically you end up with more sugar than you do protein. That makes it pro-sugar. Then you add your Milo to it. Then you add your cereal to it. Then you add your, you know, and it becomes a pro-diabetes, pro,
And
that,
you know,
insulin causes damage to the capillaries, which causes the liver to release cholesterol. So insulin damages the capillaries. The liver releases cholesterol to try to help the capillaries heal, which is why 22 beers a week isn't good for you.
And, you know, turning back, I just talked about the 50s and 60s and how this got pushed through in the 70s and 80s. But go back to the turn of the century, not this century, last century, and it was companies like Kellogg's and Sanitarium who pushed the agenda of breakfast cereals. And they were on about reducing meat intake back in 1900 or the late 1800s. And there's a whole lot of other reasons behind that and religious beliefs. And, you know, it's amazing what's been pushed onto us through the years that has been anti-science.
Yes.
So it's really interesting. Look, I've often said to people, I probably popped up as Farmer Greggy in the world of social media in 2012. And that was when we cut ties with our big milk company. And 2013, we started For Real Milk. And I share thoughts and opinions based on a lot of research I've read. I'm not a researcher. I don't have medical training. I'm not a scientific background person, but I like to read things that resonate with me and understand things. And when you, I don't want to disrespect people's choice to be a vegan, but it does change the way they think. And a lot of people are like, you just can't have a rational conversation with a vegan. And we need to understand why that is. Because if they're not eating animal products and especially meat, and dairy, things like that, that contain cholesterol, that helps the brain function. So like a vegan being deprived of fats and proteins in animal products are literally not thinking straight.
Our brain is 70% cholesterol.
You can't have a rational conversation with someone whose brain is not functioning. And that's the issue. But they're not aware. They're not aware that's happening to them. They're not aware how angry they've got with the world and with the people. And you know, they hate all people who aren't trying to save the world from itself as they see it. And it's a cult. It's a cult. They get tangled up in this and they're very self-righteous and their way is the only way.
Yes.
Until, inevitably, their body breaks down and their mind stops functioning. And then what's happening is they do become meat eaters. They're cannibalizing their own body because they're so devoid of the nutrients they need to function. They're not aware of that, but that's what's happening. And then, you know, a lot of skeletal damage happens. Their bones are breaking down and, you know, the hair's falling out and bowels stop working properly. And this, it's nasty stuff what happens to the human body when you put it under that sort of torture.
And I think you're right. I think it tends to be about 2 years that people can get away with it and feel quite good. And I remember chatting to one guy one morning and he was saying, he said, oh, I feel fantastic every day. I've got this great level of energy. And I said, well, what do you eat for brekkie? And he said, I have 2 litres of juice. And I said, what sort of juice? And he said, fruit juice. And I said, well, okay, we're going to need to check your muscle mass and your muscle quality. He said, well, isn't that healthy for me? I said, you're filling your body with sugar.
It's
first
sugar.
Up in the morning. You're running on sugar. Of course you feel good.
Yeah.
You know, it's they don't, people, I think people in general, this is the problem, isn't it? You know, they're not they're not looking at the science, because the science is so skew-whiff. And if anything is, if it's taught us anything in the last 2 years, there's science, science, and damned science. You know, it's it's been a very interesting learning curve.
And it's really interesting because a lot of the people who are probably high profile within the paleo or keto or now carnivore movement are ex-vegans. They believed in it and they tried it and they were strict, you know, to that movement. But their body fell to pieces and their mind fell to pieces and they recovered.
We were actually thinking back, we were vegetarian for 20 years. So now that I think about it, so we never went vegan. And then my oldest son, when he was married, they went vegan for a while. And I thought, well, of course he did. He had to go one better than us. And then even my other son and his wife, they were vegan for a while, totally failed at it. None of them did it for very long. And it was sort of funny because the reason we turned back to eating meat, it took us a while because we were trying to do the right thing for the planet and the animals. That was the reason. So, but for about 2 years, my hubby would get back from his jogs and would feel shaky and weak and would go for something sugary. So I did an insulin resistance test on him and he was pre-diabetic. And I tried many things in my arsenal and I've got a lot of really good stuff that I can try. I could not get rid of that damn symptom on him. So it took us about 2 years to make the decision to start eating meat again. And now we're sort of like, no, this is our lifestyle now. And especially, like, I'm sure you heard Bill Gates make the comment, I think it was around March 2021. I think it was just around the time he became the biggest farm owner in America. And he said, Western nations need to start eating more genetically modified plant-based proteins. He didn't just say plant-based proteins. He said genetically modified plant-based proteins because his two biggest things that two of the biggest genetically modified foods he makes are soy and canola. So, like, you know, I think you mentioned frankenfoods. These frankenfoods that people are eating, there's nothing real in them.
No. It's amazing. There was a doco came out a couple of years ago, called The Game Changers. And I had a lot of people, I've been bashed internationally as a dairy farmer by vegans who are going to save the planet. And a lot of them started telling me about 2 years ago, you need to watch The Game Changers. You'll change your mind then. You'll understand. So I thought, yeah, you're right. I need to watch it. And I actually filmed a review of The Game Changers that went for longer than The Game Changers. Like, I literally just analyzed everything they did in real time. I just had a chat to the camera like we're talking right now. I'd watch The Game Changers for half an hour and then pause it, and then I'll talk about what I just saw. And then I'd watch it. And it's incredible because, you know, they were about elite athletes. It was a different angle. These were elite athletes that were now performing at a higher level because they'd become vegan, and they nearly all broke down. This was not reported after the movie, but they nearly all broke down or retired prematurely during the making of or after the end of The Game Changers. And they included different studies and, like, things that actually were not backed by science or data.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have come out since discrediting. But if you're a teenage kid watching this documentary that's officially telling you that the elite athletes of the world are now performing at a higher level and we're saving the planet, because they went into a bit of the, you know, the damage that animals do to the planet and how we can save it by eating plants, again, based on misinformation and disinformation. And guess who the director of The Game Changers is?
Leo James DiCaprio. Cameron. Who was it?
James Cameron.
Oh, really? Yes, so I heard that he was one of the big, he's huge in the vegan world, isn't he, making lots of money.
So now I struggle to watch one of my favourite movies, Avatar, because it's just so much along that agenda. But he actually owns the biggest pea protein processing facility in the Northern Hemisphere, him and his wife. It was a vegan propaganda, you know, feature film on steroids.
Yeah.
That's what it was. And it's incredible. Like, that's, people can't see through that. like they're not aware of that.
Yeah.
They won't dig a little deeper and find out what was the motivation to make this.
Yeah.
And get an understanding of why is all the things they're reporting to us actually not even close to the truth?
Yes.
So people.
Yeah, one of my gurus. There's a doctor, Dr. Charles Krebs, and I've known him for about 20 years, and he was one of my first kinesiology trainers. So I do kinesiology as well, muscle testing, all sorts of stuff. And Charles he was a doctor who became a quadriplegic. He got a nitrogen bubble in his head when he was diving up near Cairns, actually. He's an American, and he got a nitrogen bubble. And because BHP or BP, one of them, sorry, I can't remember which one of them was on strike down off the Great Australian Bight, down off South Australia. And so he went into one of those deep decompression chambers, and it was for like 12 days because no one was working. And so that dissolved the nitrogen bubble, and he came out and was still a quadriplegic, but he was alive. He could easily have died. So then within a few years, he started doing some kinesiology training. And because he obviously, after he had a two-hour session with a kinesiologist after 3 years, and he felt like it was the first time in his feet and his brain had worked properly since this accident. Anyway, because he got involved in neurology, because he knew he had massive damage to his frontal cortex, he became friendly with many neurologists and researchers in that field. And around that time, George Bush Sr. had put $1 billion into brain research. Now, there's a whole other story there, but anyway. But basically, there was lots of research going on in America when George Bush Sr. was in. And because Charles knew a lot of these researchers, he sort of would always say, know where their money's coming from, you know, who's funding their studies. What is the outcome they want? Because if they don't want an outcome, they're not going to publish the study. So published studies are the only ones allowed to be seen as a general rule. He talked about the mis and disinformation within studies and how if something isn't the way they want it to be, they will manipulate it. They will remove animals from trials. They will remove tumours and say none of the animals in this trial had tumours. They will sacrifice all the animals at a certain point so that they're not seeing the ramifications that they would see in humans down the track. So he really went off one day about the shenanigans that go on in the scientific field and really who that comes from. And I remember once, and it was maybe about 2000, Obama was in, and Obama took all studies away in America from government funding to look at the dangers of GMO foods. So they stopped any funding to find out the damage of genetically modified foods in America. And I remember that happened because I loved Obama at the time, you know, like Australia, we, you know, thought it was the best thing since, you know, sliced bread. But his wife actually, when she was trying to get kids to eat more veggies, you know, and apparently pizza, once again, because of the lobbyists, they agreed that a slice of pizza could be one of their vegetable serves a day because it suited the politicians and the lobbyists. Wow. Anyway, so, yes, you got to know where the funding's coming from because otherwise they do all sorts of things in those trials in the background to make things look the way they want them to look. It's very frustrating, isn't it? And the more you start digging, the more you start digging, the more you find out. And no wonder you've got high blood pressure with all this COVID stuff.
Yeah. And you know, I have been more vocal than most people I know in Australia. Really, you know, I've shared extensively over the last 2 years, and I like to keep it to science. You know, I like to keep it to people who are qualified to speak. I don't just make stuff up and try and get fringe dweller theories on this. Although I've been told that doctors like Peter McCullough and Robert Malone are fringe dwellers, they're far from fringe dwellers.
Oh,
they're
my
mainstream.
Gosh. They're awesome, aren't they? Yeah.
Highly qualified specialists in their field.
Yes.
But I got to a point in December with the blood pressure where I had to detach from the conversation. I stopped sharing. You know, I'm like, I need to work on me right now. I need to be well. I need to be healthy. Yeah. I'm no good to anyone if I'm 6 feet under, and that's where I was heading.
Yeah.
And I still believe I'm going to do great things to share knowledge with people. I'm an educator. I'm not trained in the field of education. I'm a storyteller. I've been sharing my story about farming and agriculture and my health journey. And I believe I will still travel the world and film documentaries and connect people with people. I'm big on human connection. We've got to stop this breakdown of human connection that's been forced onto us by the plandemic.
Yes.
And I want to reconnect people with their food. I want to take them back to the farmer that grows the food. Every farmer has a story. You know, not many farmers are keen to share their story, but it's fascinating to understand the life of a farmer growing up on the land and what they go through to produce food that sustains. Well, now in Australia, 90% of people live in towns or cities. It's incredible. Yeah. Only 10% of us live in the country.
Yes.
And only 3% of us, Madonna, are farmers that grow food to feed this country. So our job, while it seems like we're becoming less important because come election time, we don't have the numbers to swing any election in any direction.
Right.
Therefore, politicians don't care about farmers. That's just a reality. But we're actually becoming, the less of us there are, the more important we are to the mass population.
Yes.
Because we are feeding and sustaining you. And we can do better. We need to bring it back to food, real food and nutrient density.
Absolutely. And, boosting and natural immunity. Our farms. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So look, I have this vision. I still think it's my mission to travel the world and interview other farmers and share their work, share their story, the story of where food came from.
Yes.
For the people who just live in towns and cities and expect food to be on the shelf when they go shopping.
Yes.
And I want to make sure we can keep doing that for the people of the world too. But we're in a bit of a transition now where I still believe strongly that real food is our medicine.
Yes.
But our real food is devoid of the level of nutrients it had 100 years ago, 50 years ago. And I'm looking behind you there at all those natural supplements. And I think that we need to supplement our diet.
Yes.
With the real food to give us what we need. Otherwise, we'll be lacking.
Yes.
And you know, I want to look towards natural supplements, not chemical concoctions that are made under patent.
Yeah.
That is the biggest industry in the world today, Big Pharma.
Yeah. Right. And that absolutely where funny. We can get things, yeah, where we can get, like I'd rather people eat, say, really good produce rather than having to do lots of supplements. There was a study done about 15 years by Dr. Henry Osiki. He's an Australian nutritionist. And he found that because our soils are so depleted, even eating organic, we need about 10,000 calories per day to get our recommended daily allowances. So we can't eat that much. We'd be as big as a house. So it's, you know, a good supplementation regime is really sensible these days. Yeah.
So it's really interesting. And we've been talking a little while. We probably should wrap up soon.
Yeah, we should wrap up. Okay. Yes, absolutely.
You're the boss. You're the boss here. But I just want to, you know, bringing it back to how we can look after this planet and the importance of real food and why I'm an anti-vegan is you just spoke about soil nutrition and all the nutrients in our food come from the soil. What we've done over generations of farming, the way we've been told is the right way to farm. We've been mining the soil of nutrients. We've been depleting the soil.
Yeah, we're not doing the crop rotation. Yeah.
Well, the further down the path we go towards plant-only crops, the less chance we have of supplementing the soil with nutrients. Our vegan friends are probably not aware, but if they eat organic plant crops, they need farm animals because what we call organic fertilizer is the stuff that comes out of the back end of our farm animals, our dairy cows, our beef cows, our piggeries, our chicken sheds. That is organic fertilizer, and that will build, in fact, rebuild the microbiome of the soil. I mean, the soil is a living organism just like us and our intestine and all of our organs. So we need animals to help with that process. So I always say vegans should love the work of an animal farmer because we're actually looking after them too, even though they don't appreciate the work we're doing. And if we just go to plant cropping and we don't have animals,
yes,
we're not harvesting animal manure, which is organic fertilizer, to rebuild the soil where the plant crops grow.
Yes.
Then we're moving towards chemical fertilizer, which actually destroys the soil structure. It destroys the microbiology in the soil. It, you know, it deteriorates the carbon matter of the soil, which then triggers more wind erosion and water erosion because the soil does not have structure that can be maintained. And we trigger all these impacts, complements of not utilizing animals to sustain our health and that of our planet. So yes, there's so many things, you know, this is not black and white. There's a whole lot of gray. The deeper you dig into all of this.
From a benefit, Dr. Zach Bush said as well that we've hit about, so there's always been about 3% of organic food on the planet, so not a huge amount. He said because so many people have been at home the last 2 years, it's actually up around 6 to 7%.
Okay.
And apparently at 13% organic on the planet, it messes with Monsanto's financials. So we're halfway there. Yeah.
Hey, it's like eating real food messes with big farmers' plan.
Yes,
to medicate
exactly.
The world.
Getting ourselves healthy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's been amazing chatting with you, Greggy. Where can people find you?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm in a bit of a transition in life right now. We've literally sold the family farm, which is the home of For Real Milk and the robotic dairy, where I've hosted 2,000 tours over the last 10 years, and we've probably seen 100,000 visitors to our farm. And I'm transitioning towards Farmer Greggy as an identity, as an educator. And I have a website now, farmergreggy.com. People can check that out to see what I'm up to, what I'm doing. I'm kind of in a nice phase of life. I've met a girl. We're getting on great. I say I've met her. We've only met online because we live in different countries. But in a couple of weeks' time, we're moving to Mexico together. And we're literally moving to a country that has no rules or regulations around COVID.
Yes.
So we can travel freely without quarantine, without testing, without mask wearing. And potentially, I might start filming some of my ideas for the documentary and connecting people with food and different cultures and different farming systems. I'm really not sure, Madonna, exactly where all this is going to lead me. You know,
it's, yes.
I'm going to be taking a sabbatical in Mexico. I'm even floating the idea of doing a travel blog in Mexico with my girl Mia, and we'll share a bit of our journey and what we see in Mexico. And, you know, tie back in the food and the culture of the people. And I've been a very big fan over the years of Anthony Bourdain and, you know, what the work he did. So I said that earlier when we were chatting. But I don't see a lot of people doing that at the moment. I just think it's a great avenue to connect people with people.
Yes.
And, hey, we are all in this together. We kind of
forget
that sometimes. Everything that's going on, we need to look out for each other and look after each other. So. So that's where I can see myself playing a role in that reconnection of people and
lifting
people's spirits and giving them some hope for a better future than they believe is coming our way.
It's the great awakening.
It is.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, I don't think the great reset's going to happen as such. It is the great awakening that will defeat the great reset.
Yes, totally. And, agree with you.
So many people, you know, I'm getting a vibe. I get a feeling for things. I kind of see things, and I'm talking to a lot of other spiritual people who are getting the same vibes.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very positive time to be alive on the planet, and some good things are happening.
I totally agree with you. Okay.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Greggy. Anything you wanted to add, or you're happy to?
No, just really appreciate you reaching out and having a chat, Madonna. It's been great. I've learned a few things too. I'm looking forward to a couple of links to follow up that we spoke about today, and you know, a couple of people that I hadn't heard of before. I've just got a very inquisitive mind, and I want to keep finding information.
Oh,
you know, that
absolutely
helps me understand things. And humans fascinate me. I'm always fascinated by human nature.
Yes.
And what compels us to act in a certain way. So, and how can we bring that back to being better and doing better?
Exactly. Moving forward with peace and love.
Always.
Excellent. Beautiful. Thanks, Greggy.
Awesome.
Love your work. Okay,
Thank
take
you.
Care.
See ya.